philosophy, wrote the 17th century astronomer and physicist Galileo, is written in that great book which ever is before our eyes, I mean the universe. But we cannot understand it if we do not first learn the language and grasp the symbols in which it is written. The book is written in mathematical language, and the symbols are triangles, circles, and other geometrical figures, without whose help it is impossible to comprehend a single word of it, without which one wanders in vain through a dark labyrinth. Welcome to the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College. I'm Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, your host. At Wyoming Catholic College, you can tell when a test on Euclid's geometry is in the offing. Triangles, circles, squares, rectangles, and lines, along with the propositions that go with them, cover every spare whiteboard and occasionally some of the windows as well. Plane geometry, that is, geometry in two dimensions, comes first. After that, the students make the quantum leap into solid or three-dimensional geometry. Dr. Henry Zepeda joined the Wyoming Catholic College faculty this year and is teaching field science and mathematics. Dr. Zepeda is our guest this week on the After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Zepeda, why do we immerse our students in geometry, and what do they come out learning?
We make our students do a lot of geometry here for a couple of reasons, but the primary one seems to be that the geometry, and especially the geometry of Euclid's Elements, is great training for the mind. We have a whole set of logical argumentation that starts out with basic principles, and the students spend two whole semesters working out the conclusions from those. So going step by step, logical step by logical step, from very basic definitions and axioms to get to some quite astounding conclusions by the end of the second semester.
The trick is you have to keep up with the assignments, because if you miss one of the assignments, you're going to miss a step in some proposition later on.
Yes, it all builds upon itself. So it's all building towards one main end. There are lots of little ends along the way, but it's all 13 books. The general drift of the 13 books is heading towards the perfect solids. There are different aims along the way. We have some books that don't help us get there. We have number books, for example, that we actually don't do here. So we kind of streamline this to focus more on this one thread of argument from plane geometry to solid geometry, and to especially the perfect solids.
All right, well, I remember that leap from plane geometry to solid geometry, and that was a quantum leap. That was a big jump.
Yeah, it's interesting. Throughout the history of mathematics education, Euclid's Elements has always been the fundamental textbook. And in antiquity, throughout the Middle Ages, and from then until about 100 years ago, most people who learned geometry would have done it, or fundamental mathematics, even their textbook would have been the Elements. And it's interesting that they stopped usually at book six. So they would do the plane geometry and do the proportions. That's the stuff that's covered in the first half of the Elements. And then they would skip the harder books, and only more advanced students would do that. But we think that it's really good training for our students to have them do some of that solid geometry. There is a huge jump when you go from looking at things that are just made in one plane to thinking about the possibilities, the geometrical possibilities that are introduced by having three dimensions.
Well, let's talk about that. Not long ago, we did a program with Dr. Scott Olson about infinity. And it seems to me that we kind of expect infinity whenever we're dealing with mathematics. So beginning with an equilateral triangle and then a square, we can make an infinite number of two-dimensional shapes, all that have equal sides. All the sides are equal, and it can be 6 billion sides, and every side is equal, and we can keep on going infinitely until we, I guess, end up with a circle. But when we switch to solid geometry, we can only make five. How odd. Tell us about the Platonic solids, or the perfect solids.
Yeah, well, we can make lots of different shapes in three dimensions, right? But it comes down to, when it comes to perfect ones, there are only five. And this is something that actually is surprising, at least at first, until you see the proof for it, then it seems quite obvious. But the students go through and they show how to make five different perfect solids. And what is a perfect solid? A perfect solid is one where all the faces are, each face of this is the same as all the other faces on it, and each face is equilateral and equiangular. So imagine equilateral triangle. What kinds of solids can we make out of this? Well, we could stick together four of these, and that works. We get a little tetrahedron, so a four-faced figure that has each side an equilateral triangle. We can't put together certain numbers of these. We can't put together five, but we can put together certain numbers of these to get things. We can get a tetrahedron. We can put together two little pyramids on top of each other to get an octahedron. So imagine eight equilateral triangles put together. So imagine a square, and then on each side of the square, above the square, imagine a pyramid, and on the bottom, a pyramid. These other ones I'm not going to ask you all to imagine, because they get very hard without being able to see them. Yeah, cube is actually quite easy. So we're able to do those. Those ones are fairly easy to see, that we can get this four-faced figure, this eight-faced figure, and the six-faced cube made with squares. Okay, well, what happens? What other ones can we make? If we go through and try to, well, as if we follow Euclid, he shows us that we can make a 20-sided figure out of equilateral triangles, and we can make a 12-sided figure with pentagons. And he then shows that this process comes to an end. We can't make any more than these. And his proof is actually very interesting for this. It's at the very end of the elements, he goes and he shows that there can't be any more. He does this by going through all the possibilities, actually. Well, of course, there are infinite possibilities, but he goes through and examines the possibilities and groups them together in a way where he's able to show which ones work and which ones don't work. And he's able to say, well, we need a solid angle when we have a perfect figure. A perfect solid figure. And to have a solid angle, you need to have the angles, the plane angles that make up a solid angle, have to be less than four right angles. If you have four right angles, if you imagine that you have just a flat surface, you have to sort of pinch that together to get a solid angle. And you do that by having the angles that make up your solid angle less than four right angles. And he goes through the possibilities. What combinations of triangles add up to angles, a solid angle that are less than four rights? And he ends up going through these possibilities for the different shapes and showing that there are only these five possible. You can't make a solid figure with hexagons, for example, because you'll end up with a plane, just a plane. Hexagons fit together in, I guess they call it a tessellated pattern. They actually can be tiled. And make a flat surface. They don't make a solid angle, and hence no perfect solid made out of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd have to have just two in order to bend them. But then they wouldn't come together.
And then if there are two, then that's not going to make a solid angle either. You need at least three. Mm-hmm. But three runs into this other problem.
Right.
So you're left with no perfect solid possible out of hexagons.
It just seems like this mathematical anomaly. It's just, I just think it's interesting to think about. There are only five. That's it.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it's not, if you just said which ones would work without going through the work, it might not seem obvious that 4, 6, 8, 12, and 20 work, but those are the numbers of faces that you can have, but any other number is impossible.
Well, let's get back to infinity and talk a little bit about conic sections. Our students study conic sections. What are those and why do they study them?
Yeah, the conic sections are the curves that you get when we talk about, there are different shapes you can get, but the when we talk about conic sections, what we really mean are the three kinds of curves that you get when you slice a conic surface with a plane. So first, let me explain what a conic surface is. Apollonius makes a conic surface by taking a circle in one plane. He takes a point that's not in that plane, and he connects that point to a point on this circle. He then spins this line around the circle, and this makes this this spindle shape, which he calls a conic surface. And he says this line can be extended indefinitely. So we have this indefinitely large spindle shape, something like an hourglass, kind of like that. And then he puts planes to it, and he sees what curves result from these, and he's able to define the curves according to three different ways of cutting this, whether you cut it in such a way that one half of the spindle is cut clean through. In other words, if you imagine part of your cone, you have the plane cutting through both sides of the cone, the front and the back, or the left and the right. That might be a way to think of it. And this makes an ellipse. It can make a circle too if it's done in certain ways, but normally it makes an ellipse, some sort of ovaly shape, right? And then we can get a parabola and a hyperbola as well. A hyperbola we get if we cut this spindle shape, which again has a top part and a bottom part, in such a way that it cuts both parts, both the top part and the bottom part. And this ends up giving us a set of two related curves, one from the bottom, one from the top, that are a hyperbola. And then we can also cut it in a way such that that the cutting plane is parallel to one of the sides, if you were of the cone, and this gives you a parabola. And he defines them. It's very interesting. He defines them in this way by the way that the plane cuts through. But he also doesn't name them until he gives a specific relationship that's known about these curves. And this relationship is between three certain lines in the curve, and he shows that there's a certain relationship that holds for a parabola. And we don't have to get into this, but it's the square on the ordinate is equal to the part of the rectangle made by the part of the diameter that's cut off in this third constant line, the parameter. And then they get even more complicated for the two other ones. But he shows that this relationship holds up for these three different curves.
And when did Euclid work all this out again?
Euclid's writing about 300 BC. And Archimedes and Apollonius, who are the two other people we study this semester, are writing within 100 years of that, or about 100 years from that.
And this is mathematics that we still use today. It's just all the same.
Yeah, it's just an amazing achievement that these men made. I think Euclid's Elements has gone through more print runs than anything else except the Bible. It's just been that influential of a work.
The heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night declares knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard, yet their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. While I don't believe that the psalmist necessarily had geometry in mind when he composed Psalm 19, he certainly could have. Our world is measurable, predictable, follows natural laws with mathematical precision, and thus reflects the ordered rational mind of the God who made it. And that is cause for great wonder. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.